Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a bit about the impact of mass democracy on Britain between the wars. Today we're looking at the brilliant book Into Battle, Britain's War by Daniel Todman, which is Britain 1937 to 41. And in the first chapters of the book, Todman sets out the kind of the panoramic picture of a country in transition. And today we're going to look about how democracy affected the hierarchical ideas of class, deference, and respectability, and how, in many cases, those concepts held firm, that they didn't simply wither away following the Representation of the People Act 1918. So, Daniel Todman writes, "The UK of the 1930s was a distinctly modern place, in ways that marked it out from both its past and its future. It was also a more democratic place than it had been a generation before, its people less obedient, less jingoistic, and less religious than their forebears. Observed from the 21st century, on the other hand, it was strikingly hierarchical, Christian, patriotic, and dutiful. Wealth and property were very unevenly divided across society, but, in striking contrast to the situation in the UK of the 2010s, the level of inequality was decreasing." So, one of the kind of the key sort of fantasies that Britain seems to have about itself is about it being, you know, the oldest democracy. Well, not really. It is one of the younger ones. It had universal suffrage was finally achieved in 1928. In 1918, all men had the vote and some women. Universal adult suffrage happened by 1928. In 1910, which was the last general election before the war, 7.7 million people cast the vote. 19 years later, that number had increased to 29 million. So that shows you how many people were not franchised by the eve of the First World War. In some ways, this sort of mass democratisation led to hopes of social democracy, of the resources of society being shared in a democratic manner. There was far more likelihood of this in the mid-1930s, the mid-1920s, I beg your pardon. And there was really one factor above all that made social welfare and the redistribution of wealth more of a burning issue for Britain's ruling classes, and that was the Russian Revolution and the frightening example that Russia had set to the rest of the world about what happens to fundamentally unequal and unreformable societies. This was the spectre that the shadow, really, that Russia cast. Now, by 1920, there was virtually no chance of an expansion of Russian power or of further revolutions across Europe. The threat had really receded in 1918-1919, but it didn't stop Western democratic politicians, particularly in Britain, feeling anxious about these sorts of things. There had been various outbreaks of violence in 1919 throughout the empire and at home, and obviously Ireland had its own revolution from 1916 onwards. And large numbers of demobilised servicemen returning home, having often bitter memories of class rule and of their war experience and fighting in the trenches, had a huge kind of distorting factor upon politics, not only with pressures towards more progressive politics, but also placing pressures upon the ruling classes that things might possibly go in a far more violent direction. And you also have, in this period of time, the emergence of the Labour Party. Unemployment in the post-war slump saw union power eroded, but fears of wage cuts when Britain returned to the gold standard after the First World War led to, obviously, the great sort of spasm of kind of industrial unrest, the general strike. I've done things on the general strike previously, which I cover in greater depth than I will now, but the general strike really emerged from a series of earlier coal strikes and the demand of the coal miners in South Wales and the north of England for better pay and treatment, and the constant threat by the mine owners that unless they received more government handouts that they would have to slash miners' wages. You have, during this period of time, the growth of a mass media, a more educated, this creates the possibility of a more educated electorate that could either make more informed choices, or was the fear of the government, the aristocracy, the newspaper magnates themselves, that demagogic populist socialist politics might break through, as they put it in modern parlance, and influence the population in ways in which the British elites didn't really want. So, Daniel Todman writes, "Fears of social disintegration were misplaced. The experience of victory did not encourage a separation between servicemen and civilians. In the mainland UK, the war ennobled peace, not violence. Post-war cuts wrecked the hopes of homes fit for heroes, but wartime wage rises and the provision of a Treasury-supported dole for the unemployed took the edge off the discontent. Income tax remained much higher than it had been before the conflict, allowing all governments to increase social spending slightly, even while sticking to contemporary orthodoxy that the budget must be balanced." One of the key things that's argued, as I've said before in this podcast, by Richard Overy, is that the two decades, the 20s and the 30s, were this a period of apocalyptic fears and anxieties. Interestingly, this is long before the kind of like the nuclear age. But there was a kind of a sense of decline of not just Britain, but Britain's empire and the civilization it purported to represent, its best days having been behind it. Many of these fantasies and fears were unfounded. Some of them ultimately found their expression in the Second World War. But the reality of the situation was that there was an intellectual climate in the 20s and 30s where there were fears of what Bertrand Russell called creed wars, vast wars being fought on the base of belief and ideology, as indeed happened. And also a sense that barbarism would finally thwart civilization. Civilization, in the eyes of Britain's bourgeoisie, was the empire bringing some kind of light and sort of magical enlightenment to the world. The political system in Britain adapted to face the challenges that it were thrown at it. The political system, as I say this now, as we all know, is in profound crisis, and one which is difficult to see how it will emerge from. And part of the seeds of that crisis have been a belief that has been really worn into British thinking throughout the 20th century, that British politics is endlessly pragmatic and will always adapt and adjust and absorb shocks and take on board any challenges and assimilate them and all that kind of thing. It did do that in the 1930s very, very successfully. Less so now, it would appear. A series of three-way party fights between the Conservatives, Labour and the declining Liberal Party created small opportunities for the Labour Party in 1924-1929 to exercise minority government. And from the second of those was obviously destroyed by the Great Depression. It was replaced with the National Coalition, and this shaped party politics all the way to the end of the Second World War. And it brought a kind of stability to politics. It's one of the few periods of time where the creation of coalitions has brought about a stability. The 30s seemed actually strangely calmer than the 1920s. A number of commentators, George Orwell being one of them, Arthur Greenwood, and Dylan Thomas even later on, Evelyn Waugh and W.H. Auden, were all of the view that there was a kind of a strange and slightly almost kind of imperceptible calm, a sort of like a suppression of emotions, a suppression of the kind of the wilder, angrier urges and instincts of man throughout the 1930s, at least in Britain. And it was as a result of partly Britain being able to not do well out of the Great Depression, but to avoid the worst of it. Britain's Great Depression lasts for about 5 years, whereas in America it's the best part of a decade. And there is a fairly robust recovery in Britain at the end, by the end of the 1930s. There was very little support during the period for the Communist Party or the British Union of Fascists. And there was a widespread belief that one of the things that distinguished Britain, one of these kind of ideas of stability that we've fed to ourselves, was that our transition to a mass democracy had been one based on ideas of mutual respect, tolerance, moderation, and the fact that the Briton, and normally the term Englishman would have been used, takes the middle road, takes the kind of the road of common sense and compromise, and that this is part of the kind of the view of Britain that is often propagated, that this is the sort of country that steers that kind of sensible middle course. And that sensible middle course, if it existed at all in the 1930s, It only existed because of specific economic, social, and political factors that created it. There's nothing innate about any country in the world that suggests that they are predestined towards stability. These things emerge from historical circumstances. They don't sort of magically pop out of the ground like leprechauns. Stability also comes from the fact that Britain was more united than it had been previously. In the run-up to the First World War, the question of home rule had brought about almost a state of civil war in Ireland, which would quite possibly have engulfed parts of the mainland Britain as well. And the creation of the Irish Free State and the creation of Northern Ireland, dominated by the Unionists and its own devolved parliament, sort of killed these passions for a generation. The Irish Republican Army, which sought to reunify a whole independent island, was really kind of, by the late 1930s, defeated on both sides of the Irish Sea. There were fairly small nationalist movements in Scotland and Wales before the Second World War, and they wouldn't really emerge until the 1960s and in Wales and 1970s in Scotland. But these were really kind of fringe organisations, because mass party politics, Conservatism, the Labour Party and the Liberal Party in Scotland and Wales at that point, to the working and middle classes, made sense. One of the key reasons in Scotland particularly for the decline of both the Conservative and the Labour parties, and the rise of the Scottish Nationalist Party, is because neither the Labour Party nor the Conservative Party have been for a considerable amount of time able to create a meaningful political or social offer to Scotland that seems to cut through en masse in a way that the Scottish Nationalist Party is capable of doing. But in a period of time in the 1930s that we're talking about, both those parties were able to do exactly that, because at that point in time, class politics and class identity was far more powerful, far more prevalent in the lives of English, Irish, Scottish and Welsh people in the United Kingdom than national politics were. After a war like the First World War, where Scots, Irish, Welsh and English people, along with Commonwealth troops and Empire troops, had stood in the trenches and fought for the flag and fought for King George, there was a kind of a far deeper and, I guess, perhaps artificial sense of national allegiance and identity that Scots people may grumble about the English and vice versa, but both of them had fought for king and country, and that was the end of it. Now, in his book The Long Shadow by David Reynolds, he makes the argument, and I think it's a convincing one, that two world wars had given Great Britain or the United Kingdom an unnaturally long lifespan, a sort of like a stay of execution, if you will, that the fear of powerful external enemies and a sense of all the nations of the islands pulling together in common struggle, and perhaps the Cold War has also kind of done this too, had created a kind of a a cohesiveness that ordinarily, under the kind of the various pressures of modernity, would not be there. And as we reach the point in history that we are currently at, where the breakup of the United Kingdom is a very real possibility, perhaps there is quite a lot in that argument that is valid. Anyway, we'll keep returning to looking at Britain on the eve of the Second World War, because the 1930s are this fascinating decade of all sorts of transitions and conflicts and changes. But I do hope you found this interesting and useful, and we are going to be developing our Patreon page a little bit in the not too distant future to make sure that patrons get additional material and some video blogs from me and some other cool stuff that I hope you'll enjoy. So do check it out, and if you can help fund the podcast, we'll be most grateful. All the best. Thank you very much. Bye bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.